A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
Hi, I'm Caroline B, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
So the words of Caroline B, one of our regular Kickstarter backers, who's part of our predictions competition standings as well. She's taken on Matt, she's taken on Catherine, she's taken on me. No doubt she's beaten us all. What we do know is she's introduced the podcast and she's helped us along our way to back it for another year. 2019, tennis podcasts every week and daily at all the Grand Slams, and well, as many others as we can possibly manage. Catherine Whittaker's here. Hello, Catherine.
Hello, David.
Hello. Hello, Matt.
Hello, David.
Hello. We've got lots to talk about this week. Yeah, we were just listening back to episode 2 here in the pub garden outside the Putney Exchange to when...
We know how to have a good time.
Yeah, we have.
We come to the pub and listen to early episodes of the Tennis Podcast.
It's that good, folks. I tell you, that's why you need to tell your friends about the show every week, because I always tell you at the end. I'll do it at the start this week. Yeah, tell your friends about the Tennis Podcast, retweet it, get everybody listening, because these are the kind of conversations we have. We're going to talk about Miami. We're going to talk about Ash Barty and Roger Federer winning the titles and Bryan Brothers in the doubles and Elise Mertens and Aryna Sabalenka. But first, better get this out of the way. This is what was said last week about the chances of Roger Federer winning the Miami title.
Yeah, I really thought that Federer might be about to go out.
Yeah, he was properly on the ropes in a way that Djokovic, who lost his set last night, was not.
No, indeed.
Really on the ropes. Yeah, I don't think new Miami suits Roger Federer particularly well. I don't think he likes the grit in the surface. I don't think he likes the change. I don't think he thinks it's the new US Open.
When you get to a certain age, Catherine, yeah. Change doesn't.
He's not hitting the ball. He looks a different player to what he looked in Indian Wells to me. He's not. He's missing on the backhand a lot. It's a lot of mistiming. He's not in my list of people that I think might win it.
But it's possible.
Really? That's a big statement.
I regretted it as it was coming out. Okay, he's in the list.
He's not even in the list.
He's on the list. Oh, goodness. Matt, wow. Say something.
I think it's possible that he would have taken quite a lot of information from that first match, and he might have adjusted and be better today.
So, what do we think, folks? I would say that in the end, that worked out pretty well for Roger Federer. And
it's worked out pretty well for you as well. Have you ever sounded more gleeful? Or, I realise this is an audio medium, but looked more gleeful.
Yes, I am quite pleased with myself. But yeah, what I was getting back to at the start of the show was episode 2. I had one of those as well over Serena Williams, who I said would win the French Open.
Listen to us, episode 2.
Yeah, well, it's
people
still there.
Listen to it now.
It's still there in the archive. You can go and hear it as I did. I said Serena Williams would win the French Open in 2012, and she promptly lost in the first round. So it happens to us all.
Was that when she lost to Rosano?
Yes. That was the first. That was what prompted Patrick Mouratoglou to get the job, wasn't it? Do you remember that?
He's never looked back.
But actually, to be fair, as we heard in the subsequent clip, Catherine, you did caveat your view of the list. Hashtag the list.
I spoke in haste and repented at leisure. And I'll tell you I repented very, very quickly, didn't I? Matt had it on the nose, didn't he? Because, look, hindsight is a wonderful thing. And he really... I stand by everything I said there about his performance against Rowdy Walbot. That was not the performance of somebody that was going to go on and win that tournament. Mm. No way. But I failed to consider what Matt did, which is that he, like a sort of tennis android, used the data and used it as a learning experience. And I think I also underestimated the determination of Roger Federer to do that and to win that title, because I thought he looked like grumpy Federer, really grumpy, and I thought he might just not quite fancy it, the new US Open.
he looked like he should have had the beard the way he was performing.
But then I think Djokovic going out helped. I think his eyes lit up and he thought, hey, this is a big chance for me to get a big title, to get, as much as he tells us he's not thinking about 109, 110, I believe it's there somewhere. So I think his eyes lit up. That was a big thing. And yeah, Matt had it on the nose, absolutely on the nose. I was quite a long way from the nose, somewhere in like the groin knee area.
I was in the belly button myself, so don't worry about it.
Take your plaudits, Matt.
Thank you. I mean, it's interesting what you say about Novak Djokovic going out, because that feels like a really long time ago now. But I remember at the time thinking, we've seen Federer grow in tournaments before when Djokovic has gone out. The one that sticks out is the 2017 Australian Open, when Federer was coming back from his knee surgery, and I think Djokovic lost to Istomin, didn't he? And Federer had been in like really scratchy form against, I think, Meltzer he played maybe, and then he put in that performance against Thomas Burdick the day after Djokovic had gone out, and he was a completely different player. And I think he does sense that, because Djokovic is his kryptonite, really, isn't he? The other thing I just want to say about Federer adapting, I was looking back at some of the Masters and how they've changed, and when there has been a change, interestingly, Federer's won. So he won on blue clay in Madrid in 2012, and he won Madrid. And he won Madrid 2009, which was the first time it was played on clay. So, and then now he's won Miami when it's switched venue. So as long as he can get through that first round where he was really quite poor, I mean, I thought he was going to lose to Albot as well in that match. As long as he can get through that, he's kind of malleable and he can adapt his game kind of to suit anything, really. If he's in the mood, he has to be up for it, as you said.
I think as well, it works the other way. There are times, the amount of times we've seen Federer, particularly at the slams in the early rounds, look unbeatable, look as though it's just all so easy.
Yeah.
And then he just runs into a day where somebody either stays with him and he loses his way, or I don't know whether the weather's an issue or whatever it might be. And actually, he did one interview with you guys on Prime this week, which I felt just shedded a bit of light on what it is like to be a tennis player at his rarefied levels. He said, you don't know before a match that you're going to play well. It's during the match you discover where you are, and you either just, you're on or you're not. And I found that really interesting, because I, you know, we sometimes talk about it and reduce it down to, oh, did he get out of the bed the right side or not? And it appears not like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, can we not all relate to that on some level?
Yeah.
I mean, at my incredibly pathetic, puny level of figure skating when I was a teenager, I mean, I could have got out of bed thinking, yeah, this is my day, and then fallen on every single jump. I mean, I can remember unfortunately
like?
Many incidences of that happening.
How much does it hurt?
And you just don't know till you step out there. You're standing there in the centre of the rink waiting for the music to start, and it could be the skate of your life, or it could be an absolute disaster, and you've no idea, and it's seemingly out of your control, which is preposterous.
Is it really painful when you fall on ice?
Repeatedly. Yeah. Yeah.
Looks horrible.
I think the first time it's all right, but yeah.
I think actually go to our social media for footage of Catherine absolutely nailing ice skating and David not quite.
Yes.
Do you remember?
Yes, that's
right. Thanks for bringing that up, Matt.
That. Thanks.
You invited him. Yes, it's, I mean, let's talk about the routes that he had, because you're quite right, a week ago he looked irritable, the surroundings were new, We've had a lot of correspondence about the stadium, which we should say has done record figures attendance-wise compared to previous editions of Miami. 60,000 more people through the gates than in any edition of Miami previously.
Which is obviously fantastic, but that confirms for me that that main stadium is not right. Because if you can be having record attendances and levels like that, which is obviously brilliant, it should feel like it.
Yes.
And it didn't in that main
stadium.
There's
an acoustics problem and a feel problem. I don't know whether they're reorganising it.
A shadow problem?
Yeah,
there's a major shadow problem.
Yeah, I just wonder whether, you know, first year, can they make some changes? But how do you add soul and feel? I don't know. That's going to be a
And yet all those outside courts had that, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that the Shapovalov TFO match that actually was scheduled to be played on Stadium 1, but it was on a heavily rain-affected day. And in the end, they had already started a doubles match featuring the Bryan brothers, who obviously went on to win, and we'll talk about that. They ended up calling off that match midway through and saying, look, you guys are going to have to wait till tomorrow to finish that. In order that they could switch the Shapovalov TFO quarterfinal to start on there as soon as the rain finished. And it was magical. It was 2 hours, 20 minutes of breathtaking, breathless tennis.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure it would have been had it been played on Stadium 1. I'm sure it would have been a good match, but it filled the stadium. Yeah, it was absolutely magnificent. And the only reason it wasn't longer than 2 hours, 20 minutes, because it felt like a longer match than that, was because they both play so quickly. And that was something that was really noticeable to me during the match. Not only the quality of it all, but I was never looking down at my phone or sort of casually, you know, while all the ball bouncing and wedgie removals going on, sort of checking Twitter or anything. Because I do that idly without even realising I'm doing it during the break between points. And I suddenly realised sort of in the third set of that I haven't been doing that at all. I've just been absorbed in this match because it's non-stop entertainment.
And the thing is about tennis stadiums as well is bigger is not better. And you know, we see that every year, like, you know, when we were in Melbourne for the Australian Open, my favourite court to be on was the court 3 because it was tight and you get an atmosphere. As long as it's full and they're engaged, that's better than kind of 10,000 people kind of spread out, not really interested because they're too high up. And that's something they're really going to need to address, I think.
And actually, if you think of the tournaments that we've been to and the ones we watch, it is often those smaller courts that people talk about in that way, in that really affectionate way, that I think that often the spectators will have this really special experience. And the players, actually, you'll often hear players talk about the amazing atmosphere they've had on a certain outside court that is nothing like on centre courts. I mean, it was jam-packed for the final for Federer, but that was probably...
Was it? There were empty seats on there.
I think eventually, anyway, it was jam-packed. Okay, maybe it wasn't at the start, but my feeling was that it was packed at the end.
And also, I think the problem is, I find it quite difficult to gauge how full it is with that court, because you see all the empty seats around the actual bit that's used
point.
For tennis, so it maybe doesn't look full, even though it technically is, kind of.
It was certainly not full during the Federer-Shapovalov match, which is the one I remember taking a picture of at the time. That one looked noticeably not full. But even when it was full, it still didn't feel quite right. Chris Clary came from the New York Times towards the end of the events, and he said, look, I don't see how you add the soul and the feel and the atmosphere that they want, that any tournament wants, given the sheer size of the American football stadium in which that relatively small 13,800 stadium sits. You know, 65,000 seat arena is what it's built inside of. I mean, it's just so difficult to recreate. But in terms of Federer's tennis over the course of that 10 days, it was almost instant, wasn't it, from that Albot performance to, I can't remember,
Filip Krajinovic.
It was a better performance. I'd still only put that as like a 7 out of 10.
What was the majestic one then?
He played Medvedev.
That was sublime. Yes, that was 61 minutes. Medvedev didn't do an awful lot wrong. He had that look of shock and horror about him for the whole match, like he didn't know what had hit him.
And we all thought that would be close, didn't we, really?
I really did, and I thought, you know, Medvedev believes in himself, you know, he's not got he's not got baggage against Federer. I think he did go out there thinking, hey, I've got a shot here, and just didn't know what had hit him after a few games, because that was brutal. And then Kevin Anderson comes along and is 6-love, 2-love down, and he doesn't know what's hit him either. I mean, incredible credit to him for making that second set competitive. He actually broke back, got it to 4-all.
That was the one being played whilst Tiafoe and Shapovalov were playing at the same time. And I remember, because Prime didn't join the Federer match because Shapovalov Tiafoe was so good, and it was so quick that
it was over only about five minutes.
I thought it was
after.
A joke when somebody said it's almost over.
He must have wanted the ground to swallow him up, Kevin Anderson.
Yeah, well, it's such a feature of Federer at the moment, these fast starts. I think I read that 11 of his last 12 wins have been inside an hour and a half. You know, he's just flying through matches. And he did it against two massive servers, Anderson and then Isner in the final, who you're thinking, right, their best bet is get this into a tie break, make it close. But Federer just broke them first game, both times.
Yeah.
And I don't, and that just shows how he wasn't needing to play himself into a match. His form was just right there by the end of the tournament.
He beat Shapovalov next, who I felt made real strides. Obviously, that's the furthest he's come in one of these events. Is it ever? I think it is.
He's done it twice before.
Montreal 2017 and Madrid
last year.
So he's going for the M's. He's going for, watch out, Monte Carlo 2020. Shapovalov will be in the semi-finals.
He got to the semis here, but he didn't get to the semis in
Montreal, Madrid.
Madrid?
Yeah. He did last year. Beat Kyle Edmund.
How come I didn't say that?
Beat really Kyle Edmund, lost to Zverev.
Okay. Well, because it still struck me that his win over Tsitsipas, Shapovalov, and then followed up with the win over Tiafoe, they felt like grown-up wins.
Yeah,
you know, like,
from a set down.
Yes. He wasn't just flashy and mind-bogglingly talented. He was gritty, and he was taking them on and just beating them at their own game almost. But the match he played against Federer, and he alluded to it before he played him, saying that I've been waiting for this match my whole life, which incidentally started I think a year after Roger Federer turned pro. But he reverted to junior mode in that match. I know Federer was exceptionally good, but I thought that was a junior-like performance from Shapovalov. I think he came out flailing around. I don't think he believed he had a chance, really. And it was the same against Djokovic at the Australian Open. You wouldn't get that from Tsitsipas. You wouldn't get that from, I don't think, Zverev. You wouldn't get that from Kyrgios. You might get a different kind of mess up by Kyrgios, you know, because of how he is. But Shapovalov walked onto that court like a child by comparison.
Yeah, I think that's really well put, actually. And there wasn't a lot of problem solving, was there? It was all going wrong and he looked like a rabbit in the headlights, and Federer was taking all his time away, and suddenly his swings looked enormous and so extravagant and indulgent, you know, to be trying to take that much time on the ball when your opponent's taking it away from you. And of course, you know, at their best, just 24 hours earlier, his swings had looked like the most poetic, beautiful thing you'd ever seen on tennis court. So there wasn't a lot of problem solving that went on, you know, in the way that there was with Kevin Anderson. 6-love, 2-love down. He just stuck in there and tried some things and, you know, got himself to 4-all. And I was so impressed with Kevin Anderson for doing that, because it must have felt horrible. With Shapovalov, didn't do that. There wasn't a lot of grit in that match, and I still think overall strides have been made in the last few weeks. And interestingly, something that Greg Rosetsky said in the Prime Video Studios, he doesn't think he'll ever do the rapping again, because he ended up losing the match after that he did that in Indian Wells, and he said tennis players are too superstitious to so we might be spared the horror.
So good on whoever beat Shapovalov in that match.
Yeah, who was it? Who is the hero? I can't remember. Who did he lose to in India?
Oh, yeah, Hurkacz.
Yes, of course. Who beat Dominic Thiem.
Yeah.
In Miami.
I think you're right. I think Shapovalov will get there with this stuff and he will learn how to handle playing these guys. But I think he walked on to the court and it was like walking into the poster that he'd had on his wall all
but
his life.
I don't know about you, but all my alarm bell, as much as it was a wonderful line for us to run and talk about in the studio, him saying, I've been waiting for this match all my life. Yeah. All my red flags went up at that point.
But when he was playing the match, I got the sense that, and I felt the same against Djokovic, he started celebrating little moments. Now, you might say, well, yeah, he hasn't got many moments to celebrate, so he's making the best of it. But I felt it was more, oh, did you see what I did there? You know I'm not going to win, but that was a good moment, wasn't it? That was like a consolation or just... And that's not right. That's not what he is going to be going forwards, I hope, at least, for his sake.
Yeah, to me, it was like he was just pleased to be there. And,
yeah.
But, you know, that experience is now over for him. He doesn't have to play Federer for the first time again. So you'd like to think that when he does play him again, he will be better equipped to deal with it. But also, I think he was nervous. I mean, not only was he going for flashy shots, but he was missing routine balls that he'd been making comfortably against TFO. I mean, I think he hit 20 unforced errors in the first set. I mean, he just couldn't keep the ball in the court. And it was a shame because it was a match that, you know, quite a lot of hype had built up around.
Again, I also think had that match been played on a different court... and that's not to let Shapovalov off the hook. I think he needs to find a way to create the energy himself if the crowd isn't giving it to him. You know, it's I think it's a lot easier for him to play big time tennis out on the grandstand court where he's feeding off the electricity from the crowd is right there. You know, they're literally, you know, right next to him, whereas on that court he wasn't getting much from them and he wasn't able to create it for himself. He seemed flat. So hopefully a learning experience for Dennis.
Good learning experience for Felix Auger-Aliassime as well, and an incredible experience. Qualified and all the way through to the semi-finals, and frankly could have beaten John, isn't it? He was a breakup in both sets.
Served for both sets.
I mean, that's that'll sting, and from what we were hearing, he went straight out and started practicing his serve straight after that loss. But the wins that he had along the way, I mean, he was making, you know, he was making matches look routine against good players, and he's 18. What makes him special?
Oh well, Greg calls him the right-handed Rafael Nadal, so that tells you how special his forehand is. I won't go so far as to say he has no weaknesses because I think the serve did get exposed a bit yesterday, but from what I'm hearing, it's nothing technical that can't be resolved, and he certainly has evidently the will to resolve it. And I do think some people were extremely harsh on his serving deficiencies in that semi-final against John Isner when, from what I can gather, if he's as nervous as we all think he was and as tight... That the Daniela was explaining that your left arm in the ball toss, if it sort of stiffens up or feels heavy, which is what she was saying throughout that match, it would cause your toss to be very wayward. But hey, look, the fact that he went out on the practice court and was bashing serves down straight away indicates that, you know, he recognises there is a problem technically that he can work on. But
great attitude generally, that, isn't it? That makes you... See, and look, I don't know him. I only know Denis Shapovalov a little bit. I'd like to see a little bit more of Auger-Aliassime in Shapovalov, who, as you said, looked happy to be there. I don't want to see that. Don't want him there for the postcard.
And Auger-Aliassime is not happy with any of what happened in that semi-final. I think he'll be having nightmares about it for a long time, and that's what you want. I want him to be kept up at night by the fact that he aimed to serve for both those sets. And yeah, he seemed absolutely gutted in press afterwards. He said the nerves felt like a virus.
Yeah.
Which is an amazing line, isn't it? You know.
And the thing is, you know, great players aren't flawless when they start. You know, it's ludicrous to expect him to be a complete player who's got it all already. I mean, that's just not going to happen. I mean, even if you take the big three, I mean, Federer, I mean, you'll know this better than me, David, but he needed to kind of sort out his emotions, and Nadal needed to adapt some surfaces other than clay, and Djokovic needed to get his health right. You know, he was retiring all the time when he was Auger Aliassime's age. You know, takes time, and what a breakthrough week for Auger Aliassime, and it's been building. It's not completely come out of nowhere, which I like. And
all those markers, the first player from the 2000s on the men's side to hit the, you know, who was born in the 2000s to break the top 50.
Yeah.
He's 33 in the world already.
His first direct entry into a main draw at Slam, he'll probably be seeded.
I mean,
wow.
His first five...
I think he's 33 in the world at the moment, but yeah.
Which would probably get him a seeding anyway with an injury.
Exactly.
First five matches against top 20 players, he won the lot.
Yeah.
Whereas Federer and Djokovic were 1-4, and Djokovic was 2-3. It's mind-boggling, really. Some of these statistics. He's going to play on grass as well. Him, Shapovalov, and Tiafoe are going to play at Queens. He's never even played on grass.
No, he skipped the whole grass court season last year to go and hone his game on clay. He thought, clay's the best place for me as a 17-year-old, and by all accounts I believe that's true. De Minaur went and played a lot on clay during his formative years. I mean, he's still 19, I mean, he's still in his formative years, but you know what I mean. And that was an incredibly mature decision as well. Like, he would have had the opportunity to, I don't know whether he would have got a wild card for Wimbledon. He certainly could have played qualies, I think, in summer last year. But he thought, no, I'm going to wait for my first opportunity to play Wimbledon, something I can only assume he'd thought about for all 17 years of his life.
I can imagine him having one or two problems on that surface, getting used to it. I can imagine if Gilles Muller were to come out of retirement, he might beat him in the first round.
Wow, Gilles Muller getting a mention. Yeah, but Gilles Muller could come out of retirement and beat a lot of people in the first round of Wimbledon.
Yeah. John Isner in the final is the man who ended up beating him. This chap's loving it. John Isner ended up beating Auger Aliassime, played against Federer. He's got the best serve on the planet in the view of many, and he got broken in the first game against Roger Federer, you know.
Yeah, and in subsequent games, 6-1 first set. And I know we have to sort of treat this final in two separate parts, don't we? There's pre and post Isner injury.
Yeah. What was it? Some sort of foot problem?
Yeah, well, he asked the physio whether he'd broken his ankle. Do you think my ankle's broken? I can only assume the physio said no, or else there's no way he'd have been sent out there to continue playing. But before that, he was being demolished by Roger Federer on serve, even, which is, I can't really think of any times I've seen that happen to John Isner.
He got broken three times in one set. I mean, I don't know the stat on when that last happened. The one that immediately comes to mind is when he lost that set 6-love to Timo Debacco, having played for 11 hours against Nicola Mahou. Oh. You know, it's that kind of level.
I love that's immediately springing to your mind. Yeah. Anything to do with Timo Debacco, immediately springing to anyone's mind.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. But it does show as well. I mean, Federer's eyes lit up at the idea of playing against this big server in this big final,
like,
didn't
like
they?
For most people, that's a nightmare. And Federer's like, no, I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to be a goalie.
He's going to be like a penalty shooter. Yeah. He said, oh, I love watching big servers.
He's the same if you play serve and volleyers.
He loves everything.
He loves
he's
beating big servers.
He's high on life.
These upbeat people.
He's no, it's so annoying. When I read those quotes, he's saying, yeah, I love watching big servers even more than I like watching long rallies. You know, you just don't know what's going to happen. It's like a penalty shootout. I'm just so excited about it all.
Bless.
And one man who wasn't happy about that first set was Mardy Fish, who'd put out on Twitter that if he had one guy to play tennis for his life over one set, it would be John Isner. And Federer just ended his life in 21 minutes.
He got quite a lot of stick for that. I found that a really interesting...
It was an interesting
gateway
take.
To debate.
Who do you have?
Nadal, I think.
I said Nadal on clay at Roland Garros.
No, because I think, no, you're falling into... I'm going to tell you off in the same way I told Greg off in the Prime studio.
Oh, yeah.
You can't choose the surface.
So you'd have Nadal ahead of Federer and Djokovic on another surface.
So it's a lottery. You don't know what surface it's going to be. You don't know who the opponent's going to be.
It.
Okay, then.
It's a blindfolded. All you're doing is picking the person who, all other things being equal, you want to play for your life in one set. I'm going Nadal.
I'm going Djokovic.
Yeah, I'm going. With those parameters, I'm changing to Djokovic. Because I think Nadal's... I think he's more vulnerable to be... kind of hit off the court maybe on
I'm picking Nadal more for attitudinal reasons than for tennis based reasons.
Djokovic,
I feel like he would
can do that
defend
as well.
My life like a raging bull.
But even if he tries to, and even if he's got that intent, if he plays Djokovic he probably won't win.
Yeah, but chances are it won't be Djokovic.
Right, okay. I hadn't thought of that.
You're going Tennessee.
Yeah.
Tennessee on your reasoning.
Yes.
But do you know what I mean? Like Nadal just wouldn't let you. He just wouldn't let it happen.
Hmm.
Unless, as I said to Greg in the studio, unless he just doesn't like you, Greg.
He's just happy to just let you go.
Yeah.
Oh, that hurts. What else have we got to talk about? So Roger Federer's won. Roger Federer goes and plays clay now. Not scheduled to do so until May in Madrid.
So Tony Godsick has said he won't play Monte Carlo.
Mm-hmm.
So expecting to see him play Madrid. Interesting if he'll play Rome.
Mm. Yeah, I doubt if he will.
Suspect he'll see how Madrid goes, but Rome is the one with the conditions most similar to Roland Garros.
Actually, one of my favourite April Fools of today was somebody saying...
so tiresome.
Somebody said that Federer had confirmed that he's going to play Newport.
I'll tell you what, if he's on 108 or 109 even, come on.
Nothing against Newport. It's just that, I mean, a beautiful tournament, home of the Hall of Fame, but it's the week after Wimbledon. You know.
Yep, their player field isn't usually glittering, is it?
On the very top level, no. No, I mean, like you say, it's the week after Wimbledon.
What would be the most comical event that Roger Federer could play?
Newport.
If he's on 108.
He played Istanbul on clay once.
But I could see him, actually, if he gets to 107 and he's got Wimbledon. Let's get in Newport as well.
You think that's less amusing than him going to Eastbourne?
I'd love it if he went to Eastbourne. Yeah. That would be hilarious.
The thought of Roger Federer staying
it
in like an old
Eastbourne,
lady's B&B in Eastbourne.
Well, Djokovic played it, didn't he?
Well, yeah, and that Serena's was quite comical.
Roddick has. I mean, there's not too many that Federer hasn't played, and that's one of them, yeah. Interesting.
It's interesting that Federer is top of the race for this year. You know,
yeah.
And it's the third year in a row he's been top of the race after Miami.
Do you know one thing that...
But, I mean, just this, that, does that... I mean, does that mean he's peaked for the season? I mean, he's not ended any of those years as the number one.
It's interesting. Daniela was telling me that Federer and his team treat the time in between Australian Open and the Sunshine Swing as the off-season. Because he plays exhibitions, he has a very busy time in December. He doesn't see that as his off-season. He sees the time in between, and actually he sees Australian Open as like the end of the season. Obviously, with the exception probably of a couple of years ago when he was coming back from that time off. But generally speaking, and she thinks that's why he plays his best tennis in Indian Wells and Miami.
Do you know, though, between 2007 and 2017, I think that's right, Federer only reached the semi-finals of Miami once. He didn't do any better than that. And all in 10 years. Although he's won it several times, he had a 10-year period. In 2007, I remember this because I covered Indian Wells that year, and he lost first round to Guillermo Cañas, with my wife watching him in the stand for the first time, and she'd been hearing about how amazing he was and how he'd lost four matches a year for the last 3 years. And she comes out first round and loses straight sets to Guillermo Cañas.
Who he just lost to in Indian Wells.
Well, that was in Indian Wells. And then 2 weeks later, he goes to Miami and he loses to Guillermo Cañas again. Right, in the third round. And then 2 years after that, he played, I think, Djokovic in the semis, and I was there. And that's one where he crashed his racket into the ground and broke his racket. And in the press conference afterwards, he actually said, to be honest with you, I'm just sick of the hard court season and I'm looking to get onto clay now.
Yeah.
And he was really fed up of it all. And if you looked at his results in both Indian Wells and Miami around that period, they're not good.
And he,
like I say, he couldn't get beyond the semis in 10 years of Miami.
And he skipped it a couple of times. And I think wasn't his last ever match against Roddick, I want to say, in Miami. And he lost it. And he always beats Roddick.
Roddick finally, it was like, okay, I know you're retiring soon, Andy. Here's a win.
Yeah. I was there for that one as well in 2013,
I think.
But it's
interesting what you say about wanting to get on the clay. I've kind of seen Federer's post-injury 2016 period as kind of... He's kind of seen it, I think, as all a bit of a bonus, really. It came out in 2017. And imagine if you're driving a stolen car, right?
What are you looking at me like that for? So it happens all the time.
I think that's a stretch, Matt.
Like, you must feel a great...
I could steal one.
You must feel a great sense of liberation to begin with. You're like, you're doing this really cool thing that no one's doing. That was Federer in 2017. He was just driving around. No one was catching him.
How does he know this stuff?
And he was having a great time.
He's played a lot of Grand Theft also.
He's stolen a lot of
cars.
But
the problem is, when you're driving a stolen car, you're waiting for someone to catch you as well. And I kind of feel that was Federer last year. You know, he'd had the really fun part, and now people were catching him up again, and he needs that fun again. And I think for Federer, that's the clay this season. That's just, this is what makes 2019 different to last year. Playing on the clay,
he's
different.
He's like a kid, isn't
he? It's fun.
He's like a bouncy Labrador.
He doesn't know how he's going to do.
Just needs a new chew toy.
She's looking at me.
Yeah.
So the moral of this tale is, kids, don't steal cars.
Yeah, that wasn't an advert.
Finally, before we move on to talk about the women's and the doubles, just mentioning Novak Djokovic there. Mentioning you there saying that Federer back in the day couldn't wait to get off the hard courts and onto the clay. Djokovic's parting shot at this tournament was, I don't know whether I'll play Monte Carlo. Yeah. Did you hear that?
He looks fed up, doesn't he?
He does look fed up. But I mean, I bring that up for a couple of reasons. One, I believe he has to play for tax reasons because he's resident there. I believe if the ones that live there have to play.
And also,
so two,
another one of his throwaway lines, isn't it? Because he's fed up of it.
When did we last hear this from you, Djokovic? Right before you won Wimbledon.
Yeah, not going to play on the grass.
And reached the Queen's final. He said, after losing at the French, I don't know if I'll play on the grass. So I found it amusing.
He did allude to whether to the off-court shenanigans and the energy he's expended. And you, I mean, I'm not surprised.
Well, he alluded
really.
To off-court shenanigans. We're assuming that he's referring to the, at least in part, to the political drama.
Yeah. But I can only imagine it would be that. But.
Well, we don't. He said there's a lot of stuff going on, didn't he? And it's it's distracted him. And but yeah, he looked thoroughly irritated. But yeah,
he'll still win the French Open in Wimbledon.
Yeah, well, exactly. The fact that he said, "Oh, I don't know if I'll play Monte Carlo," suddenly made me go, "All right, I'm definitely picking him for the French then."
Right then, Ash Barty.
Should we just do the Bryan brothers quickly, or do you want to do the doubles together?
I want to do the doubles together because I think Ash Barty deserves talking about. Sharpish.
All right, off you go.
First of all, I predicted her in the newsletter.
No, you didn't.
Kind of did.
No.
I mean, it does say that in the newsletter, but there was a wrong prediction before that.
There was a false start.
David held up the publishing deadline.
Yeah. We couldn't quite get it out on Tuesday, and in which point Kyrgios and went and lost, which meant that I couldn't get my Kyrgios Federer final that I'd predicted on the show last week. So I decided to go for Ash Barty instead, and she did win. So anyway, that worked out. But isn't she a joy? Isn't she a joy to watch?
Absolutely, 100%.
And not only is she a joy to watch, now she's got the results to go with it.
Well, yeah, that's always been my thing with Ash Barty. Like, I love watching her play, but can she step up? Like, I don't think she kind of freezes in a moment, but does she kind of rise to a moment? I've always wondered about that. Like, I remember watching her this year at the Australian Open when she played Petra Kvitova, and she had all the crowd on her side, but she wasn't really using it. That's just her personality, her style, if you like. But I did wonder whether she was, you know, whether she kind of had it in her to win big, but I mean, she does.
Do you know how I mentioned Denis Shapovalov as playing like a junior against Federer?
Mm-hmm.
This isn't, it's not at that level, of course, but I tend to find that Ash Barty carries herself as a player who wants to play, and she wants to compete. She wants to play nice tennis, but she's not sort of out there thinking, I have to win this. I have to, because I'm going to. There's nothing you can do. I'm just going to go and beat you.
Mm.
She turns up, she punches the clock, and she plays, and then she leaves, and then you see what the result is. This week it was different. I got the sense that she thought, well, it was almost a bit of the Bianca Andreescu's about her this week. Absolutely, I'm good enough. Absolutely, my game can hurt you. And here it is. Deal with it.
Yeah, I think that's a really an interesting comparison. And the fact that she played and beat Kvitova en route to the title this week, I found that really significant because, as you said, Matt, that match-up in Australia was a little bit of a damp squib. Mm. Just because, as you said, it was so hyped up and the atmosphere was incredible, but it was like she wasn't feeling that on the court. I don't know. There was a slight disconnect, wasn't there? And I know that you pointed out to me, David, during the BT coverage this week that Martina Navratilova was making quite a point about imposter syndrome in relation to Simona Halep, I think it was, and how that feeling of belonging at the top doesn't necessarily, it's not natural to some people, and I think more so women than men. And I think there's probably an element of that with Ash Barty, big element. And I think not just in terms of her personality but also her game. It's not a big bash kind of a game. I think personality wise she has some, I mean there's a fine line between being charmingly unassuming, which is a great thing, and that imposter syndrome, which is, although entirely understandable and relatable in terms of your potential success, I imagine a negative thing and something that has to be overcome. But yeah, going out there and going, I'm good enough and my game is good enough, was an incredibly uplifting thing to see.
But you know, I just stole a line from Pat Rafter just now by saying, here's my game, deal with it. That's what he said 15, 20 years ago when he played on clay, even, and he got to the semi-finals of the French Open one year, and here he is, the ultimate chip charge serve and volley, and he said, look, there's no secrets, this is my game, if you can stop it, fine, But he went out there, and he, for a while, Pete Sampras and he kind of fell out, and he took, because he got in Sampras's face, and he chipped and charged him, and he went at him, and he wasn't going to be nice about it. He was just going to present him with his own game.
Surely Sampras can understand that.
But it was, well, you know, it's just, it's the alpha male stuff, you know, but you don't associate that with Pat Rafter, is my point. Pat Rafter's lovely. Who do you know that has a bad word to say about Pat Rafter? But he did not let that get away in the way, ultimately, of him achieving his potential and even perhaps overachieving. And that's, I draw the parallel with Ash Barty because she's also just unfailingly liked. You don't know anybody who's got a bad word to say about it. And the danger is that you end up not having teeth out on the court. And she's shown that she's got teeth.
Yeah, well, it's all this... You still hear all this waff about, is there such a thing as being too nice to be a winner? You know, every time Kevin Anderson or Marin Cilic steps out to play, you hear that debate swirl around. And it came to my mind in the men's final yesterday with Roger Federer, and John Isner was heavily injured. You know, he couldn't walk. He sort of crumpled over in tears at one point, and that's a big old crumple from 6'11". And Roger Federer looked like a dead-eyed assassin out there.
And yet he's a lovely bloke.
He's and
ruthless.
His words about John Isner afterwards were, you knew, you know, deep down in there somewhere he was really feeling for him, but in that moment he had to be a cold-hearted assassin. And it really, I really, it's not something that I didn't know was there in Roger Federer, but seeing it sort of laid bare in such a crude scenario like that, I found very interesting. And it's that, I think, that we maybe would have doubted that Ash Barty had. I think, yeah, you know, there would have been times a while ago when we would have doubted if Naomi Osaka had it.
Mm-hmm.
And she certainly does. It presents itself in different ways with different people, but I'm not sure you can win the big titles without having some of that.
And also, has, just in terms of her game, has anyone ever maximised their serve so much? She outserved, yes, she outaced Pliskova 15-6 in the final.
Yeah.
Barty's 5'5".
Yeah. I mean, admittedly, Pliskova...
She's 5'5".
Yeah.
Pliskova was unwell, I mean, or at least seemed unwell halfway through that final. But I think that risk's taken something away from Barty. You're right. I mean, there was a period where she hit 6 aces in 8 points.
Right, wow.
In the second set. And it's got everything, that serve. She can slide it. She can hit this absolutely vicious kicker out wide. And it's just everything you see about what she's trying to do. It's like watching a wonderful snooker player playing combinations of shots in order to achieve a goal rather than just one big booming shot.
Variety is the buzzword of the moment in tennis, isn't it? I mean, it was the word that Greg and Daniela were using most in relation to Roger Federer's success throughout the Miami. Bianca Andreescu, yes, she can belt the ball as well, but I think what people are most taken with is her variety. Belinda Bencic, all about that variety. Ash Barty as well. This is
Sue Wei Shea is having
Where does Barty go from here? Does she go from here? She's won a Premier Mandatory Tournament, which is one below the Slams. Is she going to win a Grand Slam title in her career, in your opinion?
Do you know what? She... Right now, if we were skipping the clay and going straight onto grass now...
Where are my coins?
Where would you put her in your list of Wimbledon favourites?
Certainly top 5.
Yeah. Well, then...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to put my coin in. There we are.
He's literally doing coins.
Yeah, and she's gonna win a slam.
And
she's
only... As well.
She's only 22. She's got so many chances.
How is she still that young, Matt?
I have no
Tell
idea.
Me how that is a thing.
And...
I've got so many players, though, that I keep saying they're going to win a slam.
I know.
There's not enough to go around.
You know there's
I've
only four
I've got Serena
year,
Williams
right?
winning at least 2 more. Bianca Andreescu's going to win 10.
Do you think it'll be Wimbledon? Or Aussie?
I think she could win the US Open. I think she could, a bit like Sam Sosa did. I think that kick serve could work really well there. She actually referenced Wimbledon because I remember last year she was all the rage. Everybody was talking about how, I think she'd won one of the two tournaments coming into Wimbledon, hadn't she?
Birmingham or Nottingham.
And we were all talking about her. She ended up playing Daria Kasatkina.
No, Nottingham. She won Nottingham.
Kasatkina just messed her about, and she references that match in her post-match interview with Courtney Nguyen, the WTA insider, and said from there is when she really started making progress. I think that really upset her, that loss, and just made her double down on her determination to maximise her results from her career. So I think she'll at least reach a final, and if I'm putting on the spot and my coin's in the middle, she's going to win a slam.
No one asked you to physically put money on it.
I'll take it back now. Put it back in my pocket.
50p on the table.
It's now in my pocket.
And the thing is, so she's the 14th different winner of 14 events this year on the WTA Tour.
Yeah.
So there's so many people in contention for these tournaments.
It's awesome.
It's brilliant.
So much fun. Oh dear, we're not going to be able to get our predictions right with this, are we? So, the doubles. The Bryan brothers. Andy Murray was watching that, wasn't he?
Yeah.
As Bob Bryan just sort of, you know, dragged his metal hip out onto the court and played unreal tennis to beat Stefanos Tsitsipas and Wesley, what's his second name?
Kulhoff.
There you go. Tell us about it.
Well, the speeches were as entertaining, if not more so, than the match afterwards. It was great. I mean, they are, even without the major reconstructive hip surgery that Bob Bryan had less than eight months ago, they're an incredible story. They're 40 years old. I remember when it's Mike that has the three children, I think. When I remember Mike Bryan saying sort of 8 or 9 years ago, I'm only going to play until my children reach school age because I can't envisage myself being on the tour, you know, and that's all gone out the window. They just can't tear themselves away. I think it's something that Roger Federer's helped with, you know, sort of setting a new standard for life on tour and what's possible and what's achievable. So yeah, they're 40 years old. They've been written off so many times. A couple of years ago they were having a real dip, weren't they, and they were pretty much written off. And yeah, I mean, it wasn't their first title back. They'd won in Delray Beach, but I mean, how gutting it must have been for, not just for Bob Bryan to sit on the sidelines, but to watch his twin brother win the US Open with Jack Sock.
I mean, bittersweet, I suppose, you know.
Yeah.
Great in a way, but you must be a heart-wrencher.
Yeah, all those layers of emotions. He must have felt envious, and then he probably hated himself for feeling envious of it, because it's his brother, and just all those complicated emotions. But yeah, doing it with the metal hip, and he dives around like he's 14 years old. He's obviously has complete confidence in it.
It does make you wonder, doesn't it, whether this is actually doable for Murray?
I do find it interesting that Andy Murray didn't go with Bob Bryan's surgeon, Mr. Sue, because Bob Bryan's surgeon is the one Bob heavily recommended him to him, and I think he's a bit of a rock star surgeon. You know, he advertises himself as the only guy that can get athletes back to professional level. He's done it with a baseball player and a couple of others, I think a cyclist, and that's why Bob Bryan went with him. And at the Australian Open, when he was being quizzed about it, Bob said, yeah, I would absolutely recommend Dr. Sue to Andy. So I found it interesting, that podcast that you two did with Simon Briggs after speaking to Andy Murray, that he said, I went with the surgeon I did because she was honest with me.
Mm.
I didn't go with the rock star saying I can get you back to where you were.
It's very Andy Murray, isn't it?
It's very Andy Murray. But that doesn't mean he can't hope and wish and take some solace from what Bob Bryan did. The speeches, quickly. So, the runners-up speeches first. Stefanos Tsitsipas takes the mic. He's never been in a doubles final before, right? So he's never done this before, bless him. He's obviously trying to remember everything. Goes to, you know, thanks the ball kids, the crowds, the lines people, the caterers, you know, the lollipop ladies. And then he goes, I think that's it. Do you want to say anything? He says to Wesley Kulhoff, and Wesley Kulhoff takes the mic and goes, yeah, I'd like to thank my partner.
because Tsitsipas had not a thank you lately. Which, look, he should have done, but Wesley Kuhlhoff threw him right under the bus. And then the Bryan brothers are doing their speeches. Lovely, lovely speeches. Brilliant. Talking in very heartfelt terms about, you know, what they've been through the past year, etc., etc. And then they do the customary paying tribute to their opponents thing. And Bob goes, or is it Mike? One of them. Definitely the Bob or Mike goes, Stefanos Wesley, you've had a great tournament, well done. Stefanos, you've got a great career ahead of you. Wesley, you do too.
Which he does.
Pretty sure the pause was that long.
Slightly different type of career ahead, no doubt.
It was brilliant. It was all brilliant.
Yeah.
And it's a career for Wesley Kuhlhoff that this year involves Stefanos Tsitsipas for the rest of the year, because Tsitsipas said on Instagram that they're going to play all the Masters 1000 events together, and wow. He said it before April Fool's Day, so we can assume that he wasn't having us on. Yeah.
Which is interesting, because I assumed they only teamed up. There was scratch partnership in India Miles. I assume they only teamed up because Kuhlhoff didn't have the ranking he needed. Tsitsipas's singles ranking to get him into the draws there, which isn't the case anymore now that he's got the rankings points from Miami. But so nice that they're carrying on, and obviously
now. I mean, there's a lot of singles players giving it a go in the doubles now. Shapovalov's
doing it, yeah.
And then we're going to get on to Aryna Sabalenka and Elise Mertens, who won the Sunshine doubles titles.
A double-double.
Indian Wells and Miami. I mean, that is amazing, really, isn't it? Or is it just, actually, these are two fantastic singles players, then they're their best two singles players in the draw, and therefore they go and win together.
Well, Elise,
Azarenka and Barty. I mean,
true.
You know.
And Elise,
they got in the semi-finals.
Yeah. And they lost to Mertens and Sabalenka. And Mertens got to the WTA finals as a doubles player last year with Demi Schuurs,
is it?
That's
right, yes.
Yeah.
From Belgium, yeah.
Well done, Matt. Well done.
That was plucked from somewhere.
I didn't know that, actually. And then they broke up, and it was a bit acrimonious.
Apparently,
Mertens had said she's not going to play much doubles this year. And Demi Schuurs was a bit annoyed about it. So she went off with her own partner, and here's Elise Mertens winning everything.
So we still don't know what happened with Makarova Vesnina, do we?
No. Well, Vesnina's gone and had a child, hasn't she?
Yeah, but they when they split up, she that was because they were going great guns. They'd just won the Wimbledon title Love and Love in the final.
Why are we laughing at that?
It all went horribly wrong.
Oh dear!
Somewhere along the line, they won Olympic gold together, didn't they? Makarova Vesnina.
You're putting me on the spot there. I don't know.
You just plucked Schnurr. No, it's Bradley Schnurr. He's the one that doesn't bounce the ball, right?
Yes.
Yeah, a la Thomas Enquist.
Oh, crikey, my head's out. Is it time to go and get another drink? The pub's going to close soon.
Is it?
Yeah, I think it is. Actually, the sun's going down. It's getting cold.
You are with pub opening time.
We're going to go inside the pub now and get another round of drinks in, because this has been another Tennis Podcast brought to you in association with The Telegraph, executive produced by tennisballs.com with our mascot, Rio with a Y. Catherine and Matt and me, we're going to be back again next week with a questions special, listener questions special, guest edited by one of our biggest Kickstarter backers. We'll do that over the next couple of weeks, while there's not so much going on in the tennis world. We're going to be back in time for Monte Carlo and Fed Cup and all the clay court swing and everything else. We can't wait. Hope you enjoyed the show yourselves. Make sure you tell everybody you know about it if you've enjoyed it, and we'll be back with you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.